You're listening to Extra Sequential. We are a pop culture slash comics slash occasionally other things podcast that is broadcast weekly onto the wonderful tool that we like to call the internet. My name is Chris.
My name is Mladen. And did you mention comics in there? I know you mentioned pop culture and...
I did. I said pop culture slash comics.
Oh, I hope
really
you
should be comics slash pop culture.
I would hope so. I mean... We aren't just like a general shenanigans podcast since who sometimes
Shenanigans
mention.
Are very focused, like a laser.
And when we mention 50 sci-fi, we're talking 50 sci-fi comics here, not Buck Rogers. Although if there's a comic of Buck Rogers, well, I'm happy to talk about it.
Buck Rogers will show up. Yes, you've prematurely just displayed the theme for this week.
Before have I? I thought you announced it.
It's no, I didn't.
If people have downloaded the episode, surely they've seen the title of it by now.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, if you've noticed where, like, I'm very argumentative or...
Yeah, have you had a fight with your girlfriend or something? Are you taking it out on me?
No, I'm in a surprisingly upbeat mood. I think when I'm happy, I get really argumentative.
And what are you wearing?
That's none of your business. What are you wearing?
Is it hot in your neighbourhood? Are you rocking the tracksuit pants?
It's getting a bit awkward that you're asking me this every week now. Chris, seriously.
I think it's not every week. What are you talking about?
Our listeners do not want to know. Have you been?
Photos later. Good. I just shaved, actually.
November's completed.
It's November, which is the mow-growing month of November to raise funds for men's health issues. We did it at the at my workplace. So, we finished. So well, I shaved. There wasn't much to shave. I was telling people just a strong gust of wind would be enough to discard my whiskers off my chin. But it's taken at least 6 months off my age, Mladen. Shall we get into the news?
I'm happy to do that.
You can now watch the Neil Gaiman episode of The Simpsons, which we mentioned last week or the week before, called The Book Job. Neil Gaiman plays himself. On The Simpsons, author of such fantasy things as Sandman and whatnot. Unfortunately, you have to be in the United States to watch it on Hulu.
Which is a frustrating thing. I was going to ask, I saw this, I didn't even bother clicking because I'm like, we live in Australia. They never let us see anything.
Yep. No, we get nothing over here.
No.
Although Dark Horse Comics.
What? I was going to mention Neil Gaiman's a big fan of Perth. He loves it here, apparently.
Really, he hasn't been here in ages, has he?
Yeah, well, I've heard him bring up, like, in separate interviews, like, in the UK, like, which towns you really like, and he's like, oh, Perth, blah, blah, blah. That's nice. It's nice to hear.
Cool. Yeah. It is nice. We have lots to offer. So why are you leaving us?
Neil Gaiman or me?
Yes.
Me for a culinary journey to the far east of Australia.
Far East makes it sound like Singapore or something.
I know, exactly. It's far more exotic when I describe it that way.
Dark Horse Comics now releasing, and I think they're the first publisher to do this, everything digitally the same day as pre-roll, like 98% of their stuff. So they've already started. So this will now go to their full catalogue. So they do Buffy, Hellboy, a whole bunch of Star Wars titles. They're very good, you know, Conan and all manner of things. So beginning the December 14th, which is only a mere 2 weeks away, pretty much all titles from Dark Horse Comics will be on sale the same day, both print and digital format, allowing new technology readers to access their favourite comics at the same time as their print-oriented counterparts. So this is a pretty big move, and I think it's a pretty, I don't know if it'll be kind of a slap in the face or perhaps a slap on the back to Marvel and DC, who don't do that. They only do it with very limited titles, same date and date, digital releases of their print issued versions. So this is actually a good thing, I think. It'll be interesting to see kind of the comparisons between the digital sales versus the print sales. And maybe
I think it'll be a slow takeoff for sure, but but you know, one person who's going to not care for this, can you guess who I'm going to say? Mark Millar has...
I thought you were going to say Alan Moore and Frank Miller because I don't like anything.
I hate everything.
Mark Millar, yes.
Yeah, is it Millar?
I think it's actually pronounced Miller.
Miller.
But it's spelled Millar.
Okay. Well, he's sort of come out saying how he's not a fan of digital thing. He tried to liken it to DVDs. And saying, oh, you know, it's like doing straight-to-video thing. It doesn't work. I mean, I think the whole that analogy is pretty flawed.
What, he prefers Betamax? I don't know.
No, he's saying it's like films couldn't survive just on the DVD sales.
Oh, okay.
They have to, the film releases like the comics. I don't really agree with that. It's more like TV and just another form of watching TV, like Hulu, and they've made that work. So, but you can read his whole quote. I know Comics Beat and Comics Alliance, and everyone's kind of reported on that, but it's interesting to hear the writer of Wanted, Civil Kick-Ass. War.
That's him. Superior. Yep.
Yeah, and he's definitely weighed in on that thing. I think he's come to the defense of comic book retailers a little bit. So it's a debate maybe you and I can pick up on sometime.
Looking out for the little guy. Yeah. Sure. Finally, let's talk about crazy actor Nicolas Cage. He's we've known that he's been quite a big Superman fan, comics fan, but a Superman fan in particular for, well, pretty much his whole adult life. In fact, he named his son Kal, K-A-L, which, as we know, is the Kryptonian name of Superman, Kal-El. And he's had $1 million collection, which I believe he sold a few years ago. His former, the near-mint copy of Action Comics number 1, which is from 1938, the first appearance of Superman, was actually sold at auction for a record $2.16 million.
Wait, 2.1?
The previous record of $1.5 million.
Oh, wow. That's a fair bit.
So, yes, yeah, so that they reckon there's only about 100 copies of Action Comics 1 left in the world. So if you happen to have one in your basement.
I reckon someone whose great uncle was a newsstand salesman, they'll find a box in their attic full of unsold junk. Maybe some with torn off covers. I don't know if they did that back then. And the market will be saturated with near mint copies. Maybe cockroach-stained copies of Action Comics number 1.
It's quite the find. Apparently, they recycled a lot of paper and stuff during World War II, so they reckon in the late 30s and early 40s, not a lot of comics exist from that period.
Oh, wow. This is
all suppliers were focused on bringing down Hitler.
Through recycling. Good work. All right.
All right, let's get on to our topic of the week. Ba-da-ba-ba. So, Lincoln.
So, Chris, what?
This week we are talking about 1950s science fiction comics. We did kind of Wacky's 30s and 40s comics, if you recall, Maladdin, a few weeks ago.
Correct.
So I thought, well, actually, can I be honest with you?
What? What are you honest about?
The impetus behind this was there's a bookstore that was closing down just up the road from my workplace.
Yeah.
Everything must go, $5. And I was like, oh, I'm not going to find anything in here. But I found some pretty good stuff, actually, including stuff that I sent to you as a present.
That was good stuff. You sent me a volume of Dan Dare, the reprints from 2002 of the English comic from around that period.
True. And I also picked up a very similar kind of – there was a lot of sci-fi heroes in the 50s. It was quite the popular genre of its day.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked up Jeff Hawke, which is also an English newspaper strip, which we'll talk into again, and Rick Random, Space Detective.
Nice.
So I thought these are pretty good, actually. And, you know, I know you're probably more into the older comics than I am.
Yes.
But as I was kind of flicking through these, I thought, you know, they're black and white. There's no superheroes in them. But they're actually pretty good. And these are kind of the foundations. You know, comics obviously have a richer history than a lot of people suspect. Expect, and these tales were quite entertaining. And as I said, yeah, sci-fi was quite the genre of its day. Came in the 1950s, was certainly an interesting period for comics. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, the 50s science fiction, especially in comics, is kind of its own creature because science fiction was sort of booming after the 40s. It's sort of slowly coming in the 30s. And this was slightly before the comics code hysteria. So
yes,
a lot of science fiction comics were becoming kind of increasingly sophisticated, and they all had a brief and vibrant flourishing, and then there was a shift to kind of more juvenile content. So it's an easy period to delineate kind of slightly pre-code and around that code area, 50s science fiction. And you see kind of two main strands, and I'll be interested to see whether our examples fit these, but there's like the science fiction fantasy, which are kind of like your Flash Gordons. There's only one Flash Gordon, but, you know. And then there's the kind of closer to the hard science fiction ones, which are interested in – they don't have to be all about technical accuracy, but they're into the – rather than beating up an alien with one eye, it's what things could go wrong on a spaceship, and that's the thrilling bit, you know, or the social parables, and there's a few of those here I've noted as well. And, like, a major theme is exploration, which, and, like, this fascination with technology, which is something that's almost been lost. Exploration's kind of uncool in science fiction these days. Would you agree?
Yeah, that's, you've raised some interesting questions there, as you often do. And, yes, no, you're right. I guess, I don't want to use the word obvious.
No, go for it.
But I think, I was thinking about, say, Warren Ellis, mm-hmm. or when he does sci-fi and a lot of, or even We Three, I guess, Grant Morrison's We Three could be considered sci-fi. When straight sci-fi tales are done in comics these days, they're not, like you said, people landing on the moon and encountering strange aliens, they're not as perhaps obvious as that, though that derogatory term is perhaps a bad sort of phrase. But, there's kind of, these stories are pretty intense, and particularly when I was reading some of these, the Jeff Falk ones, they kind of reminded me of the early Star Trek series, the original series that ran in for, what, three seasons in the late 60s?
Yes.
And they've kind of got that kind of moral, and everything's, talking about, race relations.
Exactly.
Or managing humanity to man, but through this prism of, green tentacled creatures that float and have telepathic powers. And you surprisingly take it all in and don't, it's not Thunderbirds.
Yes.
It's more serious and adult than that, which I found quite surprising. I was expecting a lot of these kind of to be, the Thunderbirds are go and that kind of.
Well, it's like a hopeful period. It's a little bit of a wary period as well, but it's kind of pre, like, the worst of the Cold War, and people are still kind of excited, like, oh, technology will take us places, and are we up to the challenge, as a race? That's, like, a lot of these are about the technology's there. Can the people get over their crap to get up there?
Well, you had, like, consumerist society, and obviously it was the time of the atomic age. You had, television was, killing off the radio plays, and
sure.
I guess, men still wore hats indoors, and I've never watched Mad Men, but it seems like an interesting period.
I think you take your hat off indoors, I'm sure of that. That seems wrong, to wear your hat indoors.
Yeah.
Seems rude.
A lot of men were boarding.
Yeah, okay, sorry.
But, you mentioned the comics code, and that was Dr. Frederick Wertham kind of hated comics. hated comics, what they could potentially do to today's youth or 50s youth. So, The Seduction of the Innocent, his book came out in 1954. And a lot of the crime and horror comics of that day kind of failed, and some of them, the horror series, actually kind of became a sci-fi series.
Mm-hmm.
Things like Mystery or Astonishing, their title went away from horror and became sci-fi because that kind of bypassed the strict rules of the comic code. But it's also an interesting time for Marvel and DC, and we won't really talk about much Marvel or DC sci-fi, which I know will make you happy.
Oh, because they're so happy.
Superheroes and sci-fi, even though they do go well together, they're two different genres. So we're just talking straight to sci-fi, I guess, with human non-powered antagonists.
Okay. Right.
One of those. It was actually an interesting time. So Marvel and DC were kind of the only publishers in the 60s doing sci-fi, but before that, the earliest one would have been, Fantastic Four in 1961. And it's interesting, and I know this is the 60s, not the 50s, but bear with me, when Stan Lee first debuted Fantastic Four, up until that stage, it was still all about the sci-fi and a bit of horror, a bit of comedy, and a lot of, talking animals and a lot of TV shows, like Bob Hope, and they all had their own kind of comedians on the TV,
sure.
All had their own comics.
Mm-hmm.
So when Stan Lee created the Fantastic Four in 1961, they actually didn't even wear their costumes until the third issues. And even on the cover, if you look at the cover of Fantastic Four number one, they're sticking very closely to the big monster kind of craze that was sweeping comics at the time. And they don't really mention superhero or superpowers or anything like that. It's all very sci-fi, hard-edged kind of stuff. And even if you look at the Silver Age, which began in the 50s, a lot of the superheroes during the mid-50s, especially with DC, had kind of sci-fi origins. So, like, the Flash got retooled as a police lab assistant with chemicals and lightning. Green Lantern was now Hal Jordan instead of Alan Scott, so it was less about fantasy, more about sci-fi. But, Marvel kind of didn't really bring the science into their superheroes until the 60s. But when they did, You had, you know, gamma bombs creating Hulk radioactive spiders, creating Spider-Man cosmic rays, creating Fantastic Four. So I think a lot of these kind of sciencey, super sciencey heroes that we'll be talking about tonight,
sure,
kind of their precursor to the more, you know, all the good superheroes have science in their origin, even Superman, really.
Yeah, well, in his first appearance, they go to some lengths to try and make it at least make some scientific sense. I mean, yeah, there's the roots of that whole superhero genre in science fiction, and yeah, you're absolutely right to draw that parallel. And when science fiction kind of died in comics form a little bit, I find it sad that superheroes took over, but I know you don't. So. But you mentioned Fantastic Four there, and I mean, Jack Kirby actually was. I don't know if you've ever heard of Sky Masters of the Space Force, have you?
Ooh, no.
Yeah. It's this, it's a hard science fiction comic that, writer Dave Wood and, Jack Kirby was the penciler on that. Cool. And this was from 58 to 61 before Kirby, began to work with Marvel. This was, I think through, it was some involvement with DC, I know that. And it was all about, kind of the thrills of space travel, like plausible problems, technology and humans and exploring space. And as I mentioned, it ran from 58 to 61 as a serialized newspaper strip, which might be why you haven't heard of it. But it was quagmired in an ownership artist credit thing, which actually sank the strip and was ended with Kirby moving to Marvel. So comics history could have taken a very different path if he'd stayed there. Or maybe even not that different. I mean, ask your everyday comics fan if they know who Jack Kirby is. It's probably like a But we talked about the 50s. I'll bring it back to the general 50s. And EC Comics, I think, kind of ruled the roost a fair bit. They had a lot of success publishing science fiction comics, and a lot of which were killed in the anti-comics hysteria. And it's surprising to the level of which science fiction comics were hit by it, more to do with the social issues they were raising, that the Comics Code took resentment to. I couldn't find
took
the right
issue
one.
With.
Took issue with. That'll do. Now, Weird Fantasy is a great title, which they put out. I had a chance to reread a story from that called Judgment Day. Maybe if I describe it, it'll ring a bell. It's written by Al Feldstein, and the artist is Joe Orlando. So, good pedigree there.
That's from, I think, Mad?
Yes, correct. That's exactly right. I mean, it's about a human called Tarleton. That's his last name, I should mention. He visits this robot planet of Siberia who are seeking to be included in the Galactic Republic. And with it, they'd get all the scientific advances and the glory, so they're trying to put best foot forward. So they're guiding him through their world. They're kind of advanced to roughly 20th century level, but it's like they have robot cars and stuff. But he learns that the robots have split their society into orange and blue robots.
Okay.
They're all alike on the inside. It's just the shell that's different. So he tells them, you're not ready yet. And then the end reveal in the final panel is that Tarleton is black. Like and the implication. And remember when this was written, I think it's 52 or 53 thereabouts.
Wow.
And, the implication is maybe we'll one day get past that. You know, it's quite a hopeful thing. You know, we're not ready yet, but one day we will be, which I quite like. But, you think it's a nice little effective parable. And I'm sure it was shocking at the time, the black astronaut outrageous. And that's the grounds on which the Comics Code objected. Now, William Gaines, who was the editor of EC Comics and is kind of my hero right now, been listening to a lot of his depositions at the Senate hearings against comics and so forth. But he picked up the phone and immediately called the guy in charge, and he says, "Yeah, I'm going to call a press conference on this. You have no grounds, no basis to do this. I'll sue your ass." And then the guy, Murphy's the name of the other guy, he said he thought he was going to make a gracious concession by going, "Okay, but take off the beads of sweat on his face in the panel, and that's okay." They wanted him to change it into a white guy, but they'd drawn these little beads of sweat and the stars are reflected in them. It's quite a nice little panel. And astronaut suits are heavy. Anyway, at which point Bill Gaines responded with a hearty F you, and then they hung up, and then they published the story anyway. Now, I like those little tidbits of comic book history, but I find it interesting that even science fiction comics, which you might think could be a bit shielded from the arbitrary rules of the Comics Code, weren't. So,
He's William Gaines' life would make a good movie, I think.
Oh, for sure. You'd have to get like Philip Seymour Hoffman or something.
Awesome.
Someone. I'd see that. Hell yes.
Wally Wood was one of the great artists who also did a lot of AC work. And he did, I know he worked with Bill Gaines a fair bit, I think on like Thunder Agents and Mars Attacks and stuff like that. And a lot of people consider Wally Wood, the greatest science fiction artist, of that period.
Sure.
And I was actually flicking through the latest previews catalogue, and I did notice from Vanguard Productions, actually, they've got coming out in January, a book called Wally Wood, Strange Worlds of Science Fiction. Mm. And it's $70, so it's not cheap, but it's a 224-page, full-colour, hardcover bound. So if you are interested in this kind of period, and I think Maladin's given a little glimpse of the surprising potential of these hidden gems and these stories, then, this is not a bad place to start, actually. So it's 16 pages of bonus material and a whole bunch of different comics and covers from Strange World, Space Detective, Captain Science, and a whole bunch of stuff. So if you are, if you don't mind shelling out a bit of Christmas money, perhaps, then, Vanguard Productions, Wally Wood is the place to go. But, as you were kind of talking about the story, it's interesting that science fiction is a good platform, and I think perhaps the best platform for social commentary stories like that.
It absolutely is. I mean, good science fiction, maybe because I'm you know me quite well, and you know I'm a bit of a science fiction buff. I like to think that good science fiction comments on today, but also kind of talks about how we engage with how our technology and how we are changing and shaping our world. And a lot of these best stories do that. Whereas maybe I don't know about yourself, but I'm less interested in, say, the Flash Gordon type of stories. And we both had a chance to read a little bit of Flash Gordon. I mean, Flash Gordon actually debuted in 1934, so he's a fairly early example, but he was still being written in the up to the 60s, I'm pretty sure. I'm really only familiar with Al Williamson's work on the title from the 60s, but Flash Gordon, it's a space adventuring character. Star Wars was hugely indebted to this title, basically ripped off huge elements of it in the first film, mostly anyway, but it centers around Flash himself and the planet Mongo and the evil despot Ming the Merciless, who's kind of this Asian despot stereotype, which is your favorite. But but then Flash visits all the different kingdoms on the planet, fights giant beasts, rescues princesses. It's kind of fun space fantasy, but really the space travel aspect is a conceit. I mean, it's pretty it's fun adventure comic stuff, beautifully drawn, but don't go to it for highbrow science fiction ideas. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think, created by Alex Raymond, who's one of the great, kind of like in that Hal Foster, Prince Valiant, kind of realm of great newspaper artists. It's interesting, Flash Gordon is more escapist fantasy than traditional deep and meaningful sci-fi, but he was kind of created in response to Buck Rogers, who we'd be remiss if we didn't mention him. He was created a few years earlier in 1929, and he was really the first science fiction comic strip. So before comic books came around, comic strips, Dick Tracy and, Lou Abner and all those, they were huge. So Buck Rogers was actually the first one of that wasn't like a drama or a crime or a kind of family comedy. And he ran until 1967. But interestingly enough, there hasn't actually been a lot of original comic books about Buck Rogers. There's been TV series, a few movies and whatnot.
A couple of South Park episodes.
What's that?
A couple of South Park episodes.
Oh, was there?
Yes.
Okay. Dynamite Entertainment, who do a lot of, they do the Green Hornet and the Phantom. They do in the Shadow and HD. They do a lot of these kind of older classic and pulp heroes. They released a pretty good series, actually. It didn't last too long. It only lasted, I think, about a dozen or so issues. Buck Rogers kind of a revamp, but all the characters were the same, just slightly, different costumes and whatnot. And that was written by Scott Beattie with art by Carlos Raphael. And I read that for a few issues, and that was pretty good. Mm-hmm. And, as you said, Flash Gordon. Dynamite have also just released their first issue of their new Flash Gordon series, which I actually read today.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, you read it? Yeah, yeah. I quite enjoyed it. Plot and script by Eric Troutman. Alex Frost, who's a massive Flash Gordon fan, and I've actually got the 1980 Flash Gordon, Flash, Savior of the Universe, soundtrack by Queen, movie on DVD. There's actually an interview with Alex Ross in there because he's a big Flash Gordon fan, and you'll even notice Alex Ross's official logo that he does for his artwork. He's the painter behind Kingdom Come, a lot of other Dynamite covers these days. His logo was the same as the Flash Gordon logo. And art for this new Flash Gordon by Dynamite is actually by Daniel Indro. And that actually reminded me a lot of the 1980 film, even some of the lines of dialogue.
It seems they're drawing more from the film, from what I could gather. It's clearly a reboot, I suppose. I mean, the same. It's basically the first, either the first couple of pages or the first page of the newspaper strip, except stretched out into an entire comic. So for me, it was a perfect example of the worst of decompressed comics, because that was one page is now an entire comic book.
I actually quite enjoyed this, and I think I found it interesting that it was set in 1934 or whatever.
Yes.
I know there was a sci-fi TV series, that nobody really watched, and that was set in the modern day, and Flash was like some 20-something. But here you've got
riding a motorcycle, I'm guessing.
Quite possibly rollerblading, extreme. But I actually liked this. It was pretty good. It moves at a pretty good pace. And, you've got – and I do remember reading the Flash Gordon novels. Very few of the novels that I would read instead of comics growing up as a kid, mainly because the covers were so awesome.
Frederick Wortham would be so worried about your upbringing right now.
And you've got kind of Hans Arkov, who's the mad bearded scientist that the government kind of rejects, but he's got this spaceship hidden away. So, Flash Gordon, Dale Arden all jump in there and go to Mongo. And the last panel is no surprise here because he's on the cover. It involves some people coming from Mongo to Earth to look for Hitler, who's helping Ming the Merciless secretly, apparently. So I think there's kind of a lot in there, and I was a bit wary about this first issue, but yes, it's actually pretty good. We should also point out there has been some controversy because Arden Entertainment also have the rights and have had the rights for the last like 4 or 5 years to Flash Gordon comics, and they produce more of a kind of manga flair visually to their Flash Gordon series.
Right.
So, and you can actually read the first 2 issues of that online, and we'll put a link on our website.
I think fans of the original Flash Gordon, I don't know how familiar you are with it. What do you think they'd think of this new comic?
Well, as far as I go back, is the 1980 movie. But if you do like the 1980 movie, though, I think you'll like this comic. It's not as camp.
Yep.
I think the 1980 film was deliberately camp.
Mm.
Timothy Dalton was in there, wasn't he?
Oh, my.
Sticking his hand in a tree stump and getting bitten by some kind of lizardy creature. Some kind of... Would you remember that?
Wasn't that The Living Daylights?
No, but he was in that film as well. He's James Bond.
He sticks his hand into a tree and... No, that can't be right.
There's some kind of...
And then Benicio del Toro bites his hand off?
That was on TV the other day, wasn't it?
Yeah. I was surprised to see him in that. Whoa. But anyway,
yes.
1950s science fiction. Yeah, I mean, comparing this new one to that, I mean, the first thing I mentioned already is kind of how decompressed this is and kind of how much more filmic this is, whereas the old one definitely had a more – I wouldn't say the original Flash Gordon comics were ever as good as Prince Valiant, but they had a similar approach in terms of adventuring, and this one seems more action-oriented, which is fine. That's what people are into these days.
Well, comic books are comics – strips,
yes,
are very different storytelling.
That's true. Know? That's true. Good point.
Comic books, you have to, turn the page quickly. Panel from panel has to move. I did want to mention one of the strips collections that I read was Jeff Hawke, Overlord, this collection. Again, this is one of those reprints that I got at that $5 shop. reprinted by Titan Books, and this is actually one of those I don't know if the same with your Dan Dare book, but on the back of this, it's got praise from Dave Gibbons of Watchmen and then Brian Bolland of Batman the Killing Joke.
Mm-hmm.
This actually, Jeff Hawke series actually ran for 20 years in the newspaper strips. So not a comic necessarily, but a newspaper strip. But nonetheless, I'll be talking about it.
Yeah.
So it ran from 1955 to 1974 by Sidney Jordan and Willie Patterson. And apparently he's also hugely popular in Italy and Sweden and Scandinavia for some reason. And Brian Bolland, who is a tremendous artist. He actually ghosted some of the art in 1977, but was never published in the UK. By that time, people had lost interest, so it only saw publication in France, apparently. So the interesting thing about this, talking about the newspaper strips decompression, there's actually, like, so, I mean, I don't read newspaper strips. I don't know if you do. You know, I don't read web comics. I'd like to read, you know, at least 20 pages or something, rather than read a couple of panels a day and then wait for the next day to get the next part of the story. But this actually flows quite well. The art here is pretty awesome. The Sidney Jordan's art, it's all black and white, but it's kind of, I don't want to say modesty blaze, but it's got kind of that, everything looks realistic. It's got that kind of heavy blacks but good shading and a minor cross-hatching. There's very little just bare background. You know, everything's quite detailed. So it's actually quite a luscious-looking book. And like I said, this one in particular reminded me a lot of the early Star Trek. So the focus here is on, surprise, surprise, Jeff Hawke. And he's basically just a – he's more like a Picard rather than a Kirk. Nice. He's a lover, not a fighter. So one of the ones I opened here, this collection has about three or four series collected into one. So it wasn't but it's kind of like, I guess these strips would run over days or weeks. So here they're collected into one long narrative. This one is called Survival, which is the one I read most recently. Jeff Hawke, his mate, he's a pilot, a Canadian Air Force pilot called Mac. He's also an engineer. They're kind of traveling to this asteroid, and they get shot at accidentally by these aliens called the Orm. So Mac kind of gets injured. So the Orm kind of feel guilty, because they thought they were like bad guys. So they say, biologically, this creature is a crudity. I can find only five senses. So they say, we'll repair him. We'll make him better than he was before. And it's interesting as you read the story. Even though there's only three panels per day, they actually do quite a lot in setting up the tone. And, I mean, it's not like Watchmen levels of complexity, but there's like foreshadowing. And it's actually quite good. I was quite surprised. So they basically they get trapped on this asteroid, and Mac is sick, and they just don't know how to get off. So basically the creatures say that they'll help them. That one of their shipmates, I guess, is Donegan, and he thinks that they're going to get trapped on the asteroid and die there. So he gets space sickness, and I'm quoting there. You can't see it, but I was doing the air quotes. And he goes a bit crazy and gets cabin fever and shoots at the creatures. So the creatures who have got these kind of tentacled, you can't tell they're green.
Is this the same as Event Horizon disease?
I guess so. It's like cabin fever in space.
Okay. Yeah.
Space sickness. So the creatures say, hey, you try to shoot at us. Well, we healed your buddy, but we're not going to fix your ship, so you can stay here and die. See you later. And they just leave these guys to all kind of worry about their own fate. So Mac, who's the guy that had the accident and the creatures fixed, he wakes up. But his eyes are like Children of the Corn kind of eyes. Or not Children of the Corn, Children of the Damned. You know, they've got that kind of white eyes.
Okay.
And then he discovers that he's got kind of psi powers, and he's distant, and he doesn't really communicate much, and he doesn't talk much. And
sounds interesting.
He's pretty weird. So he makes his own fungus. So he says, I don't need food. I don't need to help you. So I'm rambling, aren't I? But
no, it's actually pretty interesting to me. Story. I've never heard of this one, yeah. what was it, Johnny Hawke?
So it's called Jeff Hawke. Jeff Hawke. So basically, to cut a long story short, Jeff Hawke says, well, we need Mac, because he's the best engineer, to fix our ship, otherwise we're all going to die here. But Mac doesn't want to help us, because the aliens have changed him so much that he's just thinking about himself and not humanity. So Jeff Hawke does, and this is why he has the Picard level of intelligence, he shoots all the oxygen reserves. He says, well, look, we're all going to die now, including you, so now you have to help us. So he kind of forces his hand. So Mac gets conflicted about helping his friends, and then the alien kind of powers leave him. And it ends in this great, great quote from Aladdin. He says, well, it's got kind of that narration, you know, that's all very heavy-handed, kind of like you could picture Orson Welles reading. For a brief time, Mac was more than just a man, but his very superiority made him less than man. Mm-hmm. He was designed to stand alone against the universe. And failed. It was man, not alone, who survived at the end.
Too true.
So it's pretty interesting. And a lot of the kind of stories here, they're not action-packed. There's very little punching or fisticuffs or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's all. There's one scene entirely set in a courtroom, pretty much, where the aliens are kind of pointing their fingers at Jeff. And I was quite surprised by this. So, that's Jeff J-E-F-F, Hawk, H-A-W-K-E, is regularly published in the Daily Express newspaper.
Yeah.
So for something more, I mean, he's more of a like an ambassador for Earth rather than a Flash Gordon Buck Rogers adventurer.
Sure.
So it's actually, so it's quite surprising that he lasted 20 years, but yeah.
Mm.
And it's a nice surprise for me.
I mean, yeah, a lot of this science fiction stuff, there's a lot of surprises. That's the good, that's the good thing. I mean, science fiction film in the 50s is a bit of a mixed bag. There are some gems in
there. It's mainly kiddies and midgets running around in dodgy outfits and stuff. I guess with comics, it's easier to sell the concepts more.
That is true. Yeah, they don't look as cheap in the comic.
Outlandish.
Except in the ones which are clearly just aping the films of the time. And those ones you can usually pick and just, yeah, they just don't seem as good. But, I mean, I don't know if you're ready to move over to Europe just yet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We mentioned Dan Dare, so I suppose that's a good place to start. And yes. Dan Dare was launched in 1950 by Frank Hampton, and that's another one that was all about kind of scientific plausibility, and they were heavy on that. I know Arthur C. Clarke was a science and plot advisor for the first arc of the strip, and helped kind of guide it in those early stages.
The man behind 2001, A Space Odyssey, am I correct?
That's absolutely correct. And
points for Bather.
You just pat yourself on the back there. And all the stories in Dan Dare, I should mention Dan Dare himself, he's the chief pilot of the Interplanetary Space Fleet, and he's joined by a pretty large cast of friends and allies, which grow during the course of the comic, including his Batman, Digby, not his Batman, his Batman,
okay.
And Professor Peabody, who's the major female role in the series, and it's nice to see a female professor. And, of course, he's got an arch enemy who's this tiny little green Martian with this enormous head called Mikon, and he's the evil little bastard from what I remember. My dad has memories of him too, just like being really scared of this little alien dude, mainly because he's one of those planet genocide kind of aliens, not the ridiculous racial stereotype aliens, genius level characters, of course. But all the stories are set on, to begin with, they're all kind of set on each of the planets in the solar system, and each planet has like their own unique inhabitants. And I know Frank Hampton sort of was trying to, you know, hypothesize. So on Mercury, the inhabitants all stay on the shattered side of the planet. They can't survive on the hot side, and they have underground caverns. Like in Venus, it's like they're within the gas and so forth. So they were he was trying to make it at least make sense to each planet in terms of biology and ecobiology, which is good stuff. And I should mention the artwork in the original Dan Dare comics is fantastic. It's all full color, and it's one of the great painted comic strips.
Yeah, so this was actually, did it appear full color at the time, or did they just color it in a reprint?
Okay. No, it was a full color at the time. This was Dan Dare's one. There's quite a few volumes that are being recollected lately. I'm pretty sure they've collected almost all of the original series now in lovely hardcover books. So that's one you can really just pick up any of the volumes and enjoy them.
And he's Dan Dare's quite a well-known, like I knew of, there seems to be a pretty good history in there with the English kind of sci-fi Avengers in particular, and I know Dan Dare was kind of, I think didn't Warren Ellis revisit the character a couple of years ago?
I think it was Garth Ennis, and I read a bit of his revisiting of the character, and it was, it felt like he didn't really like the original comics.
Okay, I'm going to revamp you if you like it or not.
Yeah,
I've actually got an interesting quote here about Dan Dare in one of my other books, Rick Random, which I'll talk about later. And the introduction talks about Dan Dare and a few of the other. And it says here, according to the publishers, 2.25 million children aged between 8 and 15 were following Dan Dare's collar for tails every week. That's 60% of all children in that age range.
Mm. It was hugely popular.
250,000,
And I know not just in England, it was being translated in Italy and Croatia and thereabouts. And another one, I guess, from the 60s, which now is still very hard to find in reprint. It's called the Trigan Empire, or Trigan Empire.
Okay.
And this is another British comic by Mike Butterworth, and it was drawn by Don Lawrence. That's another painted comic, and that one's kind of a blend of science and historicism. So the Trigan's Empire is modeled on, like, the Roman Empire, and their chief rivals are almost like the Persian Empire in a way. It's this weird blend of high and low technology. And again, it's more of an adventure comic. And but this one's very hard to get a hold of these days. I think I've seen the collected editions on Don Lawrence's website and nowhere else. And they weren't for a good price either. So I'm hoping someone does the full reprint restoration work on these just to get them, I don't know. I'd like to see these available on common bookshelves rather than just on an online shop in some tiny corner of Bristol or wherever Don Lawrence lives.
No, so is Dan Dare, is he a bit of a two-fisted philosopher, or is he...
His usual solution to things is more cunning. He's not so much the... He's more of a Picard. He's trying to broker peace, but he's willing to... Not get his hands dirty, but it'll exhaust all peaceful options or try and knock someone unconscious rather than just bashing a boulder on their head or shooting them with a ray gun or something.
And it's interesting that superheroes would take such a different tact when they would come, you know, a few years later and put their focus purely on violence.
Well, I mean, maybe they borrowed other things from it. I mean, Dan Dare, I know he had a large supporting cast of characters who were... who kind of helped him get out of situations and resolve things and helpful in their own ways. And he'd befriend the kind of the races who everyone else was, chucking crap on. Yeah. So kind of trying to come to the aid of all these other oppressed things. And I guess there's elements of that in superheroes, especially with the expanded casts, which you see of a lot of characters who could not survive without their support group. But, again, in Europe, I had a chance this week to reread a couple of Tintin books.
Okay.
And these directly apply. Destination Moon from 1950 and Explorers on the Moon from 1952. Destination Moon shares its namesake with an Irving Pichel science fiction film from 1950. I believe it's a French one. And this was all... Hergé's work was written well over a decade before the Apollo 11 moon landing and years before manned space flight. But the first book, it's really all about trying to launch a space program. And it's pretty interesting. Their professor, Calculus, he's working for the Sildavian government. That's a made-up European country, by the way. He's working for their Atomic Research Center to build their aeronautical division. And it's rich in lots of detail about kind of the then-new atomic research. It's got a really good... explanation of the functioning behind an atomic reaction within a, all ages adventure book. It's quite nice to see that kind of thing. And, meanwhile, you know, see the programs being sabotaged by spies. And, the plot is nicely balanced between, the sciencey parts and explaining science. And it's interesting itself. It's quite a hard science fiction book. But then there's still the little things like, the little character moments and stuff which you expect in a Tintin book. So it strikes a good balance between these science fiction books and just being a typical Tintin adventure. So it's almost one you can easily forget to count in this category. I mean, they still have a couple of pages of Haddock losing his pipe or lots of physical humor or a great character-rich sequence where the usually absent-minded and very peaceful professor absolutely loses his shit at a Haddock because he says something about him being like... showing off or whatever, and then he takes him on a tour and he's screaming at him, look at the work we've done, like, you know. Yeah, but it's I also like the adorable conceit that rather than taking scientists on their ship, they take Captain Haddock and Tintin and Tintin's dog, who they make an adorable spacesuit for. But it's fascinating to think, yeah, at this time the space race hadn't been this whole politicized thing. It wasn't all about taking down the Reds. This was just purely like, I wonder if we can get to the moon. And let's look at what's up there. Tintin, you're a journalist. Come on up. You see, 50s science fiction films, they would send journalists a lot in spaceships. And that's something you don't see after the 50s. Once it was this political thing, then it was all about, we have to send our best and brightest and Air Force pilots.
Yes.
But yeah, these comics are great. I mean, there's a full page of the schematic of the rocket. He pays attention to the concept of G-force and a few things he gets wrong, but the attempt's really admirable. And the second one is when the rockets launch and they explore the moon's surface, and there's a stowaway on the rocket who jeopardizes the mission. So again, lots of thrills and danger and deaths and so forth. And a scene which always shocked me as a child is when one of the characters, they're not going to make it back to Earth. They don't have enough oxygen to survive the trip. One of them, kind of while they're all asleep, he throws himself out of the airlock in a selfless sacrifice. People die in these comics, I should mention.
Yeah.
Tintin gets shot in the head in one of these. I should mention that as well. But yeah, you know, people are in genuine death throughout these comics, which is nice. But that scene quite struck me a lot as a kid, and even now, it's kind of like it's in a light adventure comic. There's these moments of like, wow, that's quite dark and very kind of unpleasant. Yeah. And that character's got a lot to try and redeem himself for as well. So it's like, wow, that's... And I'll just point out one line that I really loved from it. One of the characters going, "It's incredible. Just think, in a few minutes' time, either we'll be walking on the moon or we'll all be dead. It's marvelous." But, yeah, I'd recommend these if people who haven't read Tintin, you might enjoy these.
Oh, if people die, I've got to read them now.
Yes. There's punching. There's guns. You just enjoy these poisonings, lots of slapstick. Yeah, they're fun ones. Do you have any other? I mean, Europe, like I say, like continental Europe, like French speaking and so forth. Their science fiction scene wouldn't really find its own voice until the 60s and 70s onwards, and that's almost like a whole other show.
Like Barbarella.
I've never read any Barbarella.
No.
I imagine it being like Modesty Blaze, almost. And again, in Japan, early 50s was actually a period where science fiction, they were quite into the American stuff. American films were making their way over there. And Astro Boy was launched in 1952.
Of course.
Osamu Tezuka's. And that was the first major science fiction manga. And it was an early comic to raise the idea of kind of robot sentience and what it means to be human and taking responsibility for our creation and our technology. That's a major theme that pops up a lot in these. We can't just make stuff. We've got to take responsibility for it.
The last one I didn't want to mention was Rick Random. He's the only reason I know about this is, again, because it was $5 at this bookstore. But it's a kind of soft cover, but it's a 650-page digest, Mladen, black and white.
That's a fair bit.
Yeah, it's like a phone book, but it's not your typical trade paperback, but it's got a little nice kind of material bookmark in there as well. So it's quite a nice, handsome tone. And this collects 10 classic interplanetary comic book adventures. So Rick Random had a whole bunch of people working on his strip over the years, but most loved and when writers Bob Keston and Harry Harrison teamed up with artist Ron Turner. This was published in the prime period between 1954 and 1959. It's got an introduction. This is one of those kind of characters that kind of flies under the radar, no pun intended, of the period. But in the introduction, it kind of says that after Sputnik launched in 1957, there was a bit of a fascination, I guess, more for sci-fi. I guess it happened again after the moon landings, perhaps, but we didn't really see that take off into pop culture the way it did in the 50s. But, yeah, they've kind of – so there's 10 tales in here. And again, after being published briefly between 54 and 59, it was again published briefly in 1979 in the pages of the English 2000 AD magazine. But this collection is published by Prion, and they also put the covers at the back. You can see they've got wonderful covers back in these days. So I guess they would have had comic books reprinting the comic strips as part of the Super Detective Library series. It's actually pretty interesting. Again, it's kind of this is slightly sillier and more fantastical, I guess, than the other characters that we've talked about today. So this is perhaps more of the Flash Gordon rather than your Jeff Hawk and Dan Dare side of things. And you can kind of tell that just by looking at the jetpacks and bulky shoes and ray guns and helmets on the cover. And the titles are wonderfully nondescript. The titles of the stories are such wonderful titles, very evocative, as Kidnappers from Mars, Threat from Space, and Perilous Mission. I love how vague those titles are. So Rick works for the Interplanetary Bureau of Investigations. Sometime in the 2040s, there was a devastating war or a series of wars in the 1990s, and that basically just causes the catalyst for the governments to reunite and try and make peace and all that kind of stuff. So it's slightly silly, and it's kind of got that vibe when people in the 50s had no idea what the future was going to be like. So, again, they're like smoking indoors. They're not wearing hats indoors, but they're smoking indoors and they're still, you know, wearing... The fashion is not that different.
Yeah, from, before you move on, there is a lot of smoking in spaceships, I've noticed, in these. Really? There's a whole... I mean, I'll just mention in the Tintin comic, they make a point of it. Haddock wants to take his cigars and whiskey up on the ship. And they all go, no, you fool, we need oxygen tanks and things. And one character does take cigars up anyway. But it's a strange period where people thought, yeah, why not? If people smoke,
I guess, yeah,
and slap women, kind of, we'll be slapping women in the future too.
Still kind of in the realm of the impossible. And there was no frame of reference for space travel and future cities and things that we all take for granted today. So, I mean, yeah, even little phrases, you can kind of tell that it's made-up science. Like in the Jeff Hawke stories, there's phrases like, I wrote these down as I was reading, hard radiation, atomic furnace. Like, what are they? What does that mean? What is it? If they don't know how to explain something, they just kind of make up
something
a name
vague enough that it sounds sciencey, but not specific enough that anyone could really poke any holes in it.
Yes, it's not like you can jump on Wikipedia and verify the facts. So they've got things like Visi phones, which are kind of like mobile phones of the day. And they've got yellow hover cars and everything in here in this Rick Random is a lot more ostentatious, I guess. And you've still got the typical looking spaceships where they look like cigars with the little tripod legs that all, you know, it's interesting, the little tropes and the alien planets all have like tangled forests and kind of craggy crevices and
giant
like
spiders.
And
yeah. So many giant spiders.
It's these tropes that kind of reappear.
Yeah.
But yeah, so one of the ones I read was called Emperor of the Moon, and pretty much that title is actually an apt description. So Rick Random, which is a wonderful, it's handy that all these adventurers have such stoic, manly names, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, hi, I'm Jeff Smith. I'm here to apply for the adventurer position. So Rick Random returns to his home city after 2 years of being away, and he has only one letter waiting for him in his house, poor guy. So actually, and it's interesting that it's actually snail mail. So that's still actually hand.
It's one bit they always get wrong, isn't it?
Use postage stamps in the future and probably even lick them, I guess. So Rick actually sees the stamp on the letter, has a guy's face on it that he doesn't recognize. So he does a bit of investigation in it, and he's told that it is Leo Rex II, who basically owns the moon. So his family have basically owned the moon for generations, and Mr. Leo is the second. And he's the latest to actually own the moon, so that's a
you laugh, but if like say you know
Donald Trump,
Donald Trump, or peace, you know, if he was still alive, if Michael Jackson had the option to buy the moon, he would have done it.
Yeah,
you know, it's you know,
but I think it isn't there like international. It's like international waters. I don't know who owns. I think they are actually, aren't they?
You can't own a moon, man.
They are actually trying to own space, like they do with art, air, you know, like no-fly zones over certain countries.
Do you think in 1,000 years, descendants of parents who've received those, congratulations, you've bought a star, you know, those certificates you can buy, whether their descendants will be claiming these constellations in the name of...
And they will be like being the merciless despots.
Oh, yes. Ruling with an iron fist over the poor schnack-lock of that planet.
Sending adventurous girlfriends into the salt mines of Klandyak or whatever.
Very good.
So basically, he discovers that this guy owns the moon, and he's a relatively nice and interesting fellow, and he has a job for him when he goes on missions and whatnot. Mm. And, but so a lot kind of happens. So it's a fairly quickly paced, and the art's pretty good. It looks pretty realistic. It's actually, in some parts, it's almost, I mean, there's bare backgrounds, and it's not as realistic as say, Sidney Jordan's work in Jeff Hawke is, but it's almost, in places, reminded me of Frank Miller's work in Sin City, and that... Mm. There's a lot of, not silhouettes, but a lot of that black and white kind of, you know how in Sin City there's a lot of blacks more like than whites on the page.
Strong chiaroscuro on the page and that kind of thing.
That's the word I'm looking for. Mm. So he doesn't give definite lines, but, yeah, he kind of gives, and there's some pages here that I like that. So, I mean, look, and I've seen the Rick Random Space Detective Collection in other bookstores as well for just as cheap. So if you do manage to pick it up, and perhaps you grew up reading said tales. It's $5. Well, at least it was for me from Prion Books. And it's pretty interesting. So there's heaps there, but I think we've touched on the main guys.
Yeah, I mean, what's great about these is you kind of, it's like a little window into the hopes and fears of people in the 50s in a way. Like, yeah, the stories are about the future, but they're also about what people in the 50s hoped or were worried the future might be like. And the best one, for me, the best ones are where they kind of, their hopes and their aspirations are noble, even though they're trying to overcome, you know, political espionage or their own petty squabbles or all these kind of things, or race or whatever it is. And, like, yeah, the best, strongest stories from this period are really, yeah, those kind of pieces that, I don't know, there's a place in for these when you look at these comics from the 40s and 50s, I should say. And it's easy to say, I know horror is on a huge boom right now when we look at retro comics, especially in a huge reprint boom.
Yes.
I'd like to see more science fiction stories of these type, because horror is quite nihilistic in a way, whereas science fiction at its best is quite hopeful.
Altruistic.
Yes.
Yeah, true. Mm. I want to end on a quote if I can.
Yes.
I wrote this down as I was reading Jeff Hawke, great kind of, there's that Orson Welles like voice you can hear in your head as you read this booming narration. He played upon others as though they were mere pipes for fortune's fingers. You don't hear narration like that these days, mate.
We need more like that. So when you mentioned pipes and like playing on organs, I imagined the Count from Sesame Street, and it totally ruined that.
I thought you were going to say Phantom of the Opera.
Thanks, nice. Everyone, for joining us in our 50s science fiction retrospective. Besides the titles we've mentioned, we hope maybe we've sparked some interest in these comics. I think there's some great stuff in this period. So
yeah, it was an interesting time in comics history, and yeah, especially when sci-fi was at its zenith, I guess you could say. And I guess it kind of in the 70s movies, I guess, would be another kind of boom. I know you're a fan of kind of 70s, 80s sci-fi movies that I've never heard of.
Science fiction and the comics in the 70s also experienced a massive boom, and this is more in continental Europe. Again, America was a bit slow to catch up. Sorry, guys. I wish Australia was like spearheading something. Then I could point to, you know, Australia was spearheading the boom of
but Skippy the Bush Kangaroo.
Exactly. We need something that Australia can really, really excel at.
I did actually discover that when Flash Gordon was reprinted in Australia at the 50s and 60s or whatever, they actually changed the name to Speed Gordon, because Flash meant, you know, like flashy and show-offy, and it's pretty flash, eh?
Oh, you think you're so flash, Gordon?
Yeah. Classic.
Gordon Gozza? What would Gordon be?
Gordon Gecko.
No, like, what would you shorten that to if you worked on a construction site? Gozza.
Gordy?
Gordy.
No.
Gordy LaFlash. thanks, everyone, for joining us for this episode.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're going to have another giveaway at some point once we get closer to Christmas, which is, well, only mere weeks away. So we have prizes ready to go. We just need to figure out what our topic is and what clues we can send out. So keep your eyes and keyboard nimble-like fingers glued to the Facebook site. And if you want to shoot us an email, it's Chris with a K at extrasequential.com. And always, as always, you can catch all our previous and future episodes on iTunes as well as our website.
The World of Tomorrow. Music of the show is at purgeaudit.com. You can catch more of my writing at thefindmag.com. And, yeah, hit us up on the Facebook. Let us know any suggestions you have for things you'd like to hear us talk about, or comments on this week's show. I'd love to hear any of your favorite science fiction comics, or what you think of the 50s as 50s science fiction comics, whether you have any strong opinions about it, because I know some people are quite dismissive of it.
Well, I must have been. I was initially.
Yeah, of course.
Because I thought that'd all be kind of kiddie and weird bug-eyed aliens.
And there is a lot of that. I mean, let's be honest. But yeah.
But yeah, I mean, by judging by Rick Random and Jeff Orr collections that I read today, I was quite impressed. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we will speak at and maybe with you next week.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.